back at WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and AM 1570. We are BaltimorePositive.com. Certainly getting ready for the Maryland Crab Cake Tour this week. We're going to be out at Pappas in Cockeysville. Going to have some great old friends. Dan Rogers from the Baltimore Sun will be joining us talking about his one-man show. Also going to be joined by David Steele, former Baltimore Sun reporter as well, talking about his new book on sports and race, and probably get some Colin Kaepernick in, among some other things. And then real highlight of the holiday for me, Mike Bordick will be joining us on Friday, along with Frank Kolarik from League of Dreams. I keep calling it Field of Dreams. And they're bringing Adam Kolarik over. So we're going to have a real major league pitcher and a world champion as well. We're going to be at Pappas having Maryland crab cakes. All are brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. I'll be giving away some scratch-offs from the Ravens. Maybe you win $50 like somebody did 2 weeks ago out of Greenmount Station. Also, our friends at Window Nation, 866-90-NATION. Staying nice and warm in here now that it's cold outside with my new windows. And our friends at Goodwill. I got to give a shout-out. Wednesday, my wife and I rolling the sleeves up. We're going to be serving over 3,000 less fortunate folks on Wednesday morning at the Convention Center. All of it sponsored by Goodwill, along with our friends from Wise Markets who ponied up the turkeys to help out and make the holiday even better. My holiday's going well. I got so many great guests on this week. I sort of used bye week to go through my hit list of people I've never had on or haven't had on in years. She remembers me somehow. She at least said she did when we did our 10-second green room. She remembers me at the Baltimore Sun. She joined the Sun after I did. I started on January 6, 1986. She came sometime in 1987. She is still there 35 years later. Jean Marbella is an enterprise writer, a columnist, and a fabulous Baltimore resource. And Jean, I'll be honest, you started covering the Peter Angelos, Louis John, Mama Angelos thing a couple weeks ago. I said, I'm going to get her on, and I stand embarrassed, and I won't apologize that I've been doing radio for 31 years, and I've never had you on the show. So welcome and thank you.
I'm so glad to be here, and you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. This Angelos case will be going on for some time now.
Yeah, so. You know, I'm thinking there's not going to be a settlement in this one. If they were all going to take, well, you take $1 billion, and I'll take $1 billion, we'll go home. If that was going to happen, that probably would have happened already, right?
Yeah, there's some bad blood here, and it's going to take a while for the water to clear.
Yeah, well, I had a lot of things to talk about. I mean, the renaming of Port Covington, obviously Wes coming in and the entire Democratic thing that's going on. I texted with Heather Mazier last night as well and wished her well that she lost her election, which is very, very unfortunate, not even given my politics, but given sanity. The Angelos thing for you. You're from here. You went to Chicago. You went to a real journalism school. I went to the University of Baltimore. Here you all these years later. The Angelos thing, obviously, I am the nemesis of Angelos. I was thrown out 16 years ago. My press pass was taken away, giving Chad Steele some bright ideas that he thinks he's going to get away with. The Oriole thing and the largesse that the Orioles once were, and you were here when – you were here on Fantastic Fans Night when they announced they were building this new Camden Yards project. They didn't even call it Camden Yards then. They just called it West Downtown. All these years later, the Angelos thing is, as far as Baltimore stories go, it is just such a Greek tragedy. I mean, all the way around, and he's eating pudding and going to be going away at some point, and his legacy is just horrific for what baseball represented to a guy named Aparicio who came here on a boat from Venezuela, you know?
You know, you're right. It does have the elements of a Greek tragedy. You know, I'm not sure what his legacy will be. And, you know, he's still with us, so it's probably premature to say that. But, you know, you have to think back to who owned the Orioles before Angelos. You know, it was a guy from New York who had gone bankrupt. And, you know, I think having a hometown guy own the hometown team is positive.
It sounded like a good idea at the time.
Right, right. And, you know, look at where they are now. We just came off of this great season. You know, there are some high hopes for next season. So, you know, the ball rolls here, the ball rolls there. You know,
well, I mean, from a baseball perspective, it's terrible that they've been awful. But from a human perspective, from human capital and what that stadium represented and what the Orioles represented before the Ravens even came here, it was a one town, right? That this Camden Yards was our gateway arch. You know what I mean? Right. Like, literally, it was the centerpiece and the crown jewel of everything downtown as Governor Schaefer and Mayor Schaefer would have envisioned that all these years later, he'd be on his deathbed. People wouldn't be going to the games. There'd be a team in D.C. that had a parade.
Right.
His family is fighting over all of this blood money that was left over, not from being a great owner or a great civic steward, just literally from your cable television bill over the last 30 years that they've puffed this thing out. You know, he bought the team for $173 million. And when I wrote the Peter Principles about 15 years ago, I sat with lots and lots of folks that were up in the courtroom in New York. And you can Google Peter Principles. That's L-E-S, not and I thought that was a great title for, you know, what the Peter Principle represents. But he got $45 million in cash in the deal. So it really wasn't a $173 million deal. It was a $173 million price with $45 million of cash that was in the business that came with it. So he bought this thing for about $120 million. It's now worth well in excess of $2 billion.
Right.
What have you learned from a reportorial standpoint as far as we know there's bad blood, mom's on John's side? I'm trying to figure out if I'm team John or team Lou at this point.
You know, I'm sort of Switzerland in this. It's hard to pick sides. You know, you think of your own family, like, what are they going to do at Thanksgiving? You know, it just, So, yeah, the team is worth, I think the last estimate was pretty close to $2 billion. So it seems like there's plenty of money there. And so why are you fighting over this? You know, why are you, why is all your money eventually going to go to lawyers? So, you know, I think it's unfortunate, but it's not unprecedented. You know, there are tons of, you know, I also covered the Patarakis family feud over his fortune.
And
that was, you know, the second wife versus the children. This one, it's, you know, the biological family. There are only four of them. And the three, you know, inheritors are fighting over this. You know, all we see is what happens in the courtroom and what happens in the court documents, you know, so I have no idea what's going on behind the scenes. But it just seems like there is a lot of family issues that are being played out through the vehicle of money.
It's interesting to me because one of the reasons they threw me out and Greg Bader threw me out is they knew I was a real reporter. They knew I grew up next to you and Rodericks, and I had real leaders, and Ernie Imhoff's in that newsroom, and Jim Days, and the great Jack Lemmon, and the people Jack Gibbons and Marty Kaiser. I mean, I go through all these people and this legacy of Tim Kurkjian and Ken Rosenthal and, you know, writing truths about the baseball team when it was a big deal. The amazing part for me is they were always dysfunctional. They were always astray. John was in the family. John was out of the family. Peter hated John. Peter let John back in. John sold the rights off to the FM gypsies, and Peter came in and brought it back to AM. Like, all of this happened. None of it was really reported by your newspaper or anyone else because everyone's intimidated because he'll take your app and press pass. He will. And he won't let you around. So I would just say this. Everything about their dysfunction was private. And part of it was, we don't talk about John. We don't talk about Lou. We don't talk about family issues. Let's talk about the free agents. Let's talk about the tickets we're selling. Let's talk about our television package. Let's talk about our cable bill. And I found it unbelievably sort of tawdry a year ago when all of this started bleeding out. And I was on an airplane when this happened. I remember downloading it at an airport. I was in Atlanta, and I put on my phone and I read it for an hour and a half, and it was whatever 80 pages of just pointing back and forth, and he said mom did this, and the boy dad didn't like you, dad didn't like that you weren't a lawyer, and like all of that that went on. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, he's out of commission right now, and they are dragging every single thing that an enterprise reporter or myself would have made public if we had talked to friends of the friends down at the Four Seasons where Brady Anderson was running around. And I just found it to be like, this is Peter's worst nightmare that this has become public in any way. If it was in a publication, he'd say, oh, you journalists are all liars. You're making it up. You don't like me. This is them accusing each other in court documents. Yeah. And I have found the reading of it, and I know you've read through it and reported on it, that it is so disrespectful to him, you know, to some degree.
Right.
And I don't know that they know or care. And there's $2 billion. The fact that they can't all take $1 billion and go to their corner and get the hell out of the courtroom and figure it out, sell the team because mom wants to sell the team now. Right.
So
update me on what you were reporting a couple of weeks ago, because quite frankly, I've lost the ball in the weeds through this because I don't care. I just want to find a new owner and whatever. But from a seedy standpoint and from a reportorial standpoint, every nightmare that Peter never, because Peter was so private, he hasn't shown his face with the Orioles since 1995. The last time he did anything where he came before the franchise was the night that Ripken broke the record. He gave a 9-minute speech. He was booed horrifically. Go watch the video. Horrifically booed. When Masson shows it, they snip it out. They edit the actual speech. It's just 9.5 minutes long. I transcribed it at one point because I have a copy of it. And he was getting lustily booed for 3 or 4 minutes to the point where Frank Robinson came off of the line behind him and grabbed him and said, "You might want to wrap this up." And that was the one time Peter front faced.
Yeah.
You know, out at the stadium where he came out and said, "I'm the owner and I'm going to speak." He hasn't spoken since 1995 about any of this.
Well, you know, here's the thing. They are private citizens. And so throughout the coverage of this lawsuit, I feel like, yeah, there's a lot of family dirty laundry that gets aired. You know, any family, I think, if they were, you know, in the public spotlight, there would be some embarrassing things. But I feel like they, you know, when you own a sports team, people have a sense of ownership of that sports team. That's entirely false. It's a private enterprise. These are private people who bought a private company. And, you know, just because they're the Baltimore Orioles doesn't mean, you know, I mean, we feel this sense of ownership because, you know, they're our team, but, you know, they're like any private enterprise. They're like Under Armour. They're like, you know, some guy owns whatever, Sparrow Point. You know, so I feel like they didn't ask to be a public family. And this lawsuit thrust them into that. And, you know, that was someone's decision. And now that it's out there, it's out there. But to me, what's interesting about the lawsuit is not so much the dirty laundry, but what happens to some major institutions in town. You know, whatever you think of Peter Angelos, he created from nothing an empire that now includes a major league sports franchise, a law firm that has won billions of dollars. You know, it enriched him, but it also, you know,
my father worked in Bethlehem Steel, so I mean, I'm very familiar with all the asbestos.
Yeah, and the tobacco litigation that he did on behalf of the state against all the people that ended up, you know, with lung cancer because of smoking. So, you know, that is the law firm is also a major institution in town. Plus, he owns a substantial portion of downtown, and we don't know what's going to happen to downtown, you know, post the pandemic, post people working from home. But here's someone who, you know, whose reach was vast. And it's fascinating to me what happens now. You know, there at issue is, will the law firm be sold? Will it be dissolved? You know, the baseball team, will it be split up? Will pieces of it be sold? Will the whole thing be sold? So we're sort of, the lawsuit in many ways is this sort of referendum or this sort of signal as to what's going to, you know, what's the next step for these major institutions in town? And we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen.
I can only hope the end is nigh, you know, with all of this. And at some point there will be new ownership at some point. I think I'm pretty convinced of that the league is not going to let these kids and this goofy family run it, that there will be something that will happen that will be triggered upon his death. Right. But mom owns the team though. Right. Like that's.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mom owns the team now that dad's not operating. So if she wants to sell, she will. Where's the end of the, what's the crux of it for people who haven't read 100 pages of this?
Set it
up for us, Gene.
Well, okay. So Peter Angelos, of course, bought the team,
August 13, 1992.
Very excellent, excellent. You win the trivia round for Baltimore. But yeah, so
Actually,
when he
93,
bought
my
that,
bad, my bad.
yeah, so he bought that with partners. You know, Tom Clancy was involved,
Pam Shriver,
tennis
Jim McKay,
player.
Sergeant
Yeah,
Shriver,
yeah.
all that. Yep.
And so apparently Peter Angelos owns about 2/3 of the team. So 60-something% of the team. So that's what's at stake here. It's still the majority, you know, but there are a bunch of different, you know, the estate of Tom Clancy still owns a piece of it. So they own 2/3 of the
team. He bought pieces
team.
Of it back. I spoke to Jim McKay's son, Sean McManus, who runs CBS.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Sean told me Peter made an offer to his family after McKay died, and he bought it back. I know Pam Shriver sold her a piece. I think Steve Jeppy's out, even though he's sort of still there. I don't think he really owns a piece of the team anymore, from my understanding. I could be wrong. But again, it doesn't matter to the court, right? I mean, to the court, this is he said, she said, or they said, he said in this
right.
John and Mom versus Lou, kind of, sort of. And what are they asking? What are they trying to
accomplish? Well, you know, Mom has been trying to sell the team, or she wants to prepare for an eventual sale of the team. And so she's enlisted Goldman Sachs, all sorts of, you know, bankers, lawyers to sort of, I don't know if it's, you know, you put together, it's like when you sell a house, you put together what it is that you have on offer. So she has done that. But we have been told by sources, this is from a story that Jeff Barker wrote, that John would like to maintain a majority stake in the team.
That's
and
not
maybe
a shock.
Sell off.
That's not a shock. Yeah. And the brother's accusing him of keeping the stake to move the team to Nashville.
Right. And I think, you
first
know,
reported by me,
issues.
By the way, about 4 years ago. And everybody's like, oh, that he don't like Angelou.
Right.
She's just making stuff up. And then the court papers came out. I was on the plane. I turned to my wife. I'm like, oh,
like,
my God.
See?
The brother is accusing the other brother of doing exactly what I've been reporting for 3 years. So, you know, two points for me in those cowboy boots for John down in Nashville.
But I think a lot of things get said in a lawsuit to score various political points. And John has sworn that the team is not leaving. So who do you believe? You know, I think Lou has just intimated that this is part of John's, you know, overall plan. And this is why he's trying to consolidate, you know, control of the team.
Well, at the very least, to leverage Nashville against Baltimore, there is no long-term lease. So, and I've also learned that, you know, Steve Bisciotti, who was recently excommunicated me from the media after 26 years, or thinks he has at least, that his stake in the Civic Project per the Maryland Stadium Authority. And I've been to Wrigleyville and seen what they've done in Chicago. I've been down to Atlanta where they built a whole neighborhood.
Right.
I've been to all of these stadium projects because it's what I do. And understanding where gambling is, where mixed development is, where entertainment districts are, and they got a golf thing going on down there, a casino that wasn't there before, that whatever parcels of land and parking lots that can become what Philadelphia has with their little live bar that sits between the stadia up there, that whatever the future of the Camden Yards Entertainment District will be, Steve's kind of tied to whatever this wacky baseball family does based on going to the state and getting two long-term leases. The Ravens lease is up in 4 years. It's been 30 years, 1998. We're
That's
there.
Hard to believe.
23 right now, right? We're getting there. That the Orioles are now out of lease. We're in the 32nd year, 33rd year going into
for
the
Orioles. Yeah, we're on, I think, a one-year extension of some sort.
Well, the long-term
which
lease
next year.
Is really the secret and the honeypot.
Yeah.
And if John Angelos had full control of this to twist Nashville into Baltimore, it's going to cost Wes Moore more money and Annapolis more money to keep the Orioles here.
Yeah, I mean, if I were a gambling person, I would bet they're going to sign a lease. I mean, there's $600 million that the state is going to give them for improvements if they sign a long-term
and whatever
lease.
They give the Orioles, they have to give the Ravens, which was all part of
the poison pill back
in the 90s. Yes.
Right. And the condition of that is you sign a long-term lease with a no-get-out-of-town clause. You know,
the get-out-of-town clause doesn't exist. And I think that plays into Lou's litigation in regard. Maybe trying to get fans to say he's trying to take the team or whatever.
Right.
But my issue as a journalist and as a citizen and even as a fan is, if the team's going to be here for the next 30 years, go down the West, cut your best deal, and let's keep the team here. You know, let's sell the team conditioned upon it must remain in Baltimore, as opposed to you're buying franchise X with sort of an open loophole to take the team wherever you want to take it, which, and listen, you've been here a long time. We fought to keep the baseball team, right? I mean, Baltimore's, the Orioles were always going to be in D.C. Ask anybody that was associated with Evermann Williams, right? We kept the baseball team. We lured and stole a football team and had that built. Boy, if Baltimore had to go do that right now, if we had to go steal a baseball or a football team, 2022, if we wouldn't have the currency to do that.
But, you know, Major League Baseball, I think their interest is keeping the team here in Baltimore. We're an original Major League city. You know, why would Major League Baseball want to see the Orioles, you know, get in a Mayflower van and head to Nashville? You know, so a lot of forces are in play to keep the team in town, regardless of who owns it.
What happens at the end here? Well, you said that we're not near the end of this. I mean, you're the one in the courtroom, so you tell me where
surprised.
The end of this is. Jean.
Yeah, I mean, it could settle tomorrow. You know, there, it is such an opaque process. Only the people, you know, behind closed doors really know what's going on. But my sense is that there must be, you know, it's about money. So there must be a number, right? Or there must be something that would get the two sides together. They, you know, they're under court ordered mediation. I think that kicks in at a certain point if they're still, you know, apart. And there's always a chance, most like cases like this generally settle out of court. You know, there's no reason to go into the courthouse and rip each other to shreds, you know, forever.
They seem like they're enjoying it thus far.
Yeah, but you know, not is like you and me, the nerds who'll read 80 pages of court documents. So a lot of it, you know, hasn't really played out in open court to date. It's mainly been lawyers arguing about each other. But as soon as, you know, the last hearing, Georgia Angelos and Lou Angelos were there. They were prepared to testify. And the judge said, no, I can make my ruling without it, without their testimony. And people seemed a little disappointed. But maybe at a certain point that will happen. And I think once there's a prospect of Georgia Angelos on the stand, you know, talking smack about her son, I mean, that's just such a horrifying prospect. I feel
and
like
you that thought that was going to happen 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. You know, you've covered court cases when someone sits in the hallway, you know, because they're not supposed to be listening to what's going on in the courthouse. You know, you expect them to testify. And in fact, when the judge didn't call any witnesses, one of Georgia's lawyers said, oh, Mrs. Angelos is here and perfectly, you know, willing to answer any questions you have. And the judge was like, no, that's not necessary. Something along those lines. And Lou was there as well. I didn't see John, you know, but there, you know, one of the motions recently was for John to join in with Georgia on one of her motions. So it seems like John wants to, you know, be in on this, whether he wants to testify or not, who knows? But that would be, you know, that would be like Perry Mason. I
Jean,
think,
now
you
that
know,
we're reconnected, kind of the day that that's going to happen, please text me. I'll bring crab cakes. I'll bring popcorn. You know, I'll do whatever I need to do at this point. And a little bit of angst on my part after having my career taken away 17 years ago. Jean Marbella is here. She's from the Baltimore Sun. She does great things there. You can follow her out on Twitter. I do as well. She's been doing this a long, long time, 35 years at the Baltimore Sun. Let's get off baseball, football, sports, all that. Let's talk a little bit about newspapers. I mean, obviously, some of your former colleagues are at the Banner. I've had some of them on. I have Dan coming on Friday. I remember a two newspaper town. I'm a News American guy, as you remember, from back in 84 and 85. The state of journalism and the fact that you've dedicated your life to this, I have dedicated my life to it for better or worse, maybe a little more radio entertainment side. But my father, when he died in July 1992, my father died very angry at me at the end of his life. And he was so mad at me because I left the Sun. I left the Sun in January 92, and he said to me, you're going to get a gold watch. You'll be there the rest. You got a job for the rest of your life. You're going to have a gold. And here, 30 years later, what's happened to journalism, and I am I am such a heart newspaper guy. You know, I'm good with digital. I'm good with all that. I don't grab the paper and read it. But anytime I do, when I touch it, it's something that means a lot to me.
Right.
And seeing this second thing come in, at a time when there needs to be more opinions and more reporting, and the size of the sun obviously shrinking over the last 30 years. What's journalism for you at this point? I mean, what gets you out of bed in the morning as a reporter to make this thing happen and report on things like this that are important to the community?
For me, the job has always been the same. It's just the sort of vessel or the vehicle by which your stories, you know, reach eyeballs. And so for me, my job really hasn't changed that much, except for, you know, now we're feeding both the digital beast and the print beast. And, you know, I must say the Sun, the industry as a whole is not in a good place. But the Sun is doing quite well. You know, our digital subscriptions are doing really well. And that, of course, is the future. And that would help us if we would get more digital subscriptions. And, you know, even if it's at the expense of print ones, because that saves us ink and paper and gas for the trucks to go driving all over town. So, sorry.
No worries.
I will talk to you later. but anyway, so it's, you know, it's in a good place in that, the digital revolution really changed how we do business. But when you look at the landscape now, who do you trust online? Do you trust some guy, you know, who you never heard of, who has no affiliation? Or do you trust someone like Nestor, who everyone's name, whose name has been around town for decades? The Baltimore Sun, who's been here for, you know, more than a century. And in fact, you know, the Angelo story, I will always remember the day it broke, because that was the night we were having a party to celebrate the Sun's 185th birthday. Okay. So I was responsible for maybe four or five people missing the big party. But
I remember the 150, by the way. I worked there during
the
150. That
boat.
Was enormous. That was like Reg Murphy was all about that, Gene, you know, right?
Yeah. I came later that year. Yeah, but everyone still talked about it. There was the poster, and everyone went on whatever boat that was in the harbor. Yeah. So, you know, I think there's always going to be a need. Like, no city can get along without, you know, journalists. I mean, how does anyone know what's going on? And from reliable people. So, I mean, I think it's, you know, the banner, it's quite impressive that they have this new model. We'll see if it, you know, how long it sticks around, if there's a market for that. But, you know, the more the merrier. I think, you know, competition in the olden days, you know, as you say, there was a News American, there was an Evening Sun, there were, you know, competition is always good, I think. You know, you can get very lax if you're the only game in town. So,
well, even I showed up at the Sun in 86, right? January 86, a little before you. And there was a famous story of Mike Davis and Marty Kaiser fighting in the newsroom. Over a picture of the Mayflower van. It was the night of the Mayflower van happening. Because it was the Sun papers had photographers, but the Evening Sun and the Morning Sun, I don't want to say we didn't like each other, but... Uh-huh. If an Evening Sun reporter had a scoop, they weren't sharing it with the morning paper in the morning.
Yeah.
They were holding it, right? So there was even competition within competition.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Back then, you know, we shared certain resources, like we shared the library and maybe the photo staff.
Thank God for Paul in the library in the morgue, right?
Oh, Paul is still there.
Paul McCardle, I love you.
Paul McCardle, yeah. Paul McCardle is the keeper of the flame, the keeper of all institutional knowledge. But yeah, you would go to the library and you wanted the clips on something that happened at the school board. And you would find out that, like, an Evening Sun reporter had those clips, and you're like, what is he working on? So yeah, there was within the building, there was some real, you know, brother, it's like a civil war essentially.
Well, when journalists compete, you win out there as the public. Gene Marvell is here from the Baltimore Sun. All right, last thing for you. New government, Westmore. I'm still in a state of shock to some degree, all this, these years later, and you mentioned trusted resources. I thought after Trump that the thing that will be the truth over the next 10 or 15 years, especially for young people, is seeking trusted people, trusted resources, you know, out in the world. And I stand astonished that a Republican ran the state for 8 years, right? Like
Right,
that in
right.
a state that's 70, 75% Democratic, that Larry Hogan won once, he won twice. This Wes Moore thing and the pro Baltimore thing and the red line being killed and a governor for 8 years who acted like Baltimore was somewhere in Virginia or Pennsylvania or Delaware. The fact that there will be a focus on Baltimore. One of the reasons Baltimore's falling apart is not enough people have focused on it. Because if we did, we could and we shall and we will. Wes and the new regime and this particular election, which probably looks more like an election from 30 or 40 years ago, if you're talking about Democrats sort of putting their foot down in the state and saying, we're not having fake news.
That was quite a stunning victory. And I think it took a day or two for people to realize, wait a minute, we'll have a Democratic mayor at City Hall, we'll have a Democratic mayor in Annapolis, we have a Democratic president in the White House. It's like, let's get some stuff done. This is like an alignment for a city like Baltimore, which spent wasted a lot of time in fights with Donald Trump, calling it a rat hole, and with Larry Hogan, as you say,
Not to mention some mayors going to prison too. That
Oh, just a few, one or two here and there. So yeah, I think there's actually some hope for the future. I'm afraid to say that because in Baltimore you get used to being smacked down. You pop up and you say, oh, look, something good. So but a fresh start can be good here.
I would say this: there's a lot of people that kick the sun around in town for whatever their politics or
Like the
whatever.
Orioles,
No,
that's what we're
I'll
here
just say
for.
I want to give it where it's straight. I mean, if there were no Baltimore Sun, if there were no real reporters like yourself and your staff, and I'll give Fenton and anybody at the Banner, Pam Wood, any of those people credit to say that bringing down the gun trace task force, bringing down mayors for Healthy Holly, and I'm just talking, that's in the last 5 years, right? That these things don't happen, institutionally. I mean, Kathy Pugh had that thing all set up with a bunch of rich people that it would never come out. And now it came out and embarrassed some friends of mine, quite frankly, for their involvement in it. That doesn't happen without people like you, serious people, and without your institution and the institutions that are the guardrails for democracy, the guardrails for making sure that whatever Wes is doing, whatever Brandon's doing, it's on the up and up. And I think they should have a healthy, not respect, but they should have a healthy fear of the truth in journalists that we are going to report what's really happening, not what you're paying us off to not say or making us cough and look in the other direction. I'm appreciative, all because I've had a love-hate with the Sun over the course of
Oh, yeah.
years, and one we all
Everyone
have,
has.
right, in one way or another, right? And I remember some things written about me that I didn't think were fair or honest or certainly not accurate over the course of time. But there is an importance in what you do, what institutions do, that, yeah, we're all clapping for Wes now, and he might be president, he might do all, but in the meantime, let's hold these people accountable for making the place better. And I think that that's the role of journalists everywhere, quite frankly.
Man, that should be our mission statement. We're the watchdogs. And I think it's human nature. If no one's watching you, there's this tendency to misbehave here, a little bit here, a little bit there. So we're all human and we all need to a little bit of scrutiny.
What are you working on next? Promote something
Oh
here.
my
Come on for
God.
me.
I'm working on a story. It's a nice story. Fort Meade, where all the spies are, all the NSA, all the intelligence people, they have realized that that job can be it takes quite a mental toll on people. You're sitting in a room at a computer waging war basically halfway around the globe. Then you come home and your wife says, honey, what how was your day? Well, you can't say boo.
I have a buddy that's NSA for life, and I literally texted with him yesterday. I have never, ever, ever had a conversation with him
Like,
about what he
what did
does.
you do today?
And I
And
know
so
to not even ask him because he can't tell me anyway.
And so they're starting this new center that's going to open on Thursday. That'll be like a resource for like if you're having trouble sleeping, you're having trouble with your girlfriend, something is wrong. Here's somewhere you can go confidentially, get help and whatever. Because if you work in that field, there's always this fear that if you were to seek psychiatric help, psychological help, suddenly you'll lose your clearance, you'll lose your job. And so this is a very confidential, you know, low key place to go and just say, hey, I'm having trouble with X. What do you think? And they'll find you a counselor, a yoga class, whatever. So that's,
they come do yoga with me if they want.
Oh God, are you a yoga? Are you a hot
yoga?
Oh,
I am full on. Yeah, I've been full on for 20 years. Yeah, I'm bendy.
Oh man, I got it. We'll do that one day.
Please, please. Yes. Jean Marbelli here for the Baltimore Sun. She's a columnist, enterprise writer, and most importantly, a reporter. She went to a good school, and she's been here for 35 years doing it. I hope you guys follow her out. She's obviously been working on the Angelos family mysteries, as they are. Hey, next courtroom for them? And this thing got pushed off a couple weeks ago. When's the next thing happening?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure if it's been rescheduled. There was supposed to be something last week, and, you know, like everything, you know, like reporters, they asked for an extension.
Put it off till after the holidays so we can all have a meal and give some gifts.
Right, right.
It was great having you on. Please, it was really great to have you on. Stay in touch. I always like having the old colleagues. And you remember me from being a kid back, right? I mean, I was a mess when I was a kid, right?
No, I mean, I just remember you were like you are now, except, you know, you were bouncing off walls. You were, you know.
Sandy McKee would say the same thing, and I shared her desk. So, Jean, thank you very much. Keep up the great work. We'll keep reading, keep subscribing, and certainly keep following you out on social media.
Thanks a bunch.
Crab cake next time. Gene's going to be upset with me. I'm giving crab cakes to Dan Rogers on Friday. We're going to be out of Pappas doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour presented by the Maryland Lottery in conjunction with our friends at Window Nation and Goodwill. That'll be Friday. Dan Rogers, David Steele, two Baltimore Sun alums. I didn't work with David at the Sun, but I did work with Dan. I've also fly fished with Dan. 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock. So I'm going to make Dan tell a bunch of lefty craze stories as well on Friday, which are always my favorites. And we're also going to be joined by Mike Bordick, Adam Kolarik, and Frank Kolarik from League of Dreams. Catonsville coming together with Dundalk in Cockeysville. We'll be at Pappas 2 to 5. Appreciate that. I'm Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore positive.